Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sanghaṃ namassāmi. Settling in for our afternoon session. Usually the energy shifts, so we all start out, we've got a much bigger group, and we're all caffeinated and ready to go. And then there's attrition. Yeah. We sit, we walk, we have a meal, we'll check our phone, there's some texts. Just do, we got to fix some things. And we sit down for the afternoon. Where are we at? We are fundamentally a different person than the person who started the day, right? And that doesn't have to be a bad thing. The afternoon can be a time of very good and relaxing meditations. It'll be a time where we apply a lot less energy on the back half of the day, but that doesn't mean we get less results. In some ways, the results we get tends to be more from seeing which way things go and being like, oh, hey, look at that. Look at what my mind just did. And oh, I can be with that. Yeah, I don't have much choice. I'm too sleepy to do something about it. Or even like, well, I've been trying this one approach with all of my effort for like 3 hours. What if I just don't do it that way? And then we try it in a slightly different way. We're like, oh yeah, it kind of, oh, that kind of released, that kind of let go. And this is what, meditation practice, oftentimes we don't know what we're working with, but the one thing we do learn over time is that we always benefit from a variety of approaches. We have different energy levels, we have different levels of mindfulness, we have different levels of like investigative tools available to us. Sometimes we have relaxing meditations, and sometimes we have meditations where we have to struggle just to stay focused. But this variety of circumstances doesn't mean some sits are bad and some sits are good. It means that each time we get to apply ourselves in different ways. And since effective practice of the Eightfold Path requires a sort of eightfold path, it requires like different methods and different ways of releasing suffering. This can work for us. Sometimes we're cultivating energy and investigation. Sometimes we're cultivating tranquility and letting go. Sometimes we get results where our mind is very easy to direct, and sometimes we're getting results where we can just let things wash over us, and we're like, oh wow, this doesn't have to be so much work. So just seeing what we move through, what mind states we're going through, and in the afternoon, it's often we'll just see where it goes. Yeah, maybe take your hands off the wheel and see what kind of momentum you have after practicing through the morning. And it can sometimes be very nice. Yeah. So we've started a bit of momentum in the direction of looking at Kunti, looking at our patients. They have some good reflections. So sometimes it just takes the word or the concept to be pointed out. And you're like, oh yeah, I do this all the time. But now that you mention it, if I don't think about doing it, I tend to miss some opportunities. But when it's pointed out to you, you'll be like, oh, wow, yeah, no, I can totally, I realize I've been kind of annoyed at so and so for a couple of days now. And as soon as you said, well, this is a great opportunity for practice, I'm like, that's right. The next time I could have been annoyed by them, I said, well, this is a great opportunity for practice. And your whole relationship with that person suddenly shifts. You're like, wow, this person is a fantastic tool for meditation. I'm so glad they're here. And it's a funny way of doing things, but this is precisely the difference in the shift to being like a dedicated practitioner is you do start to see the world in this way. You start to really look forward to the times when you don't get your way, when things don't go the way that you planned, because if they do go the way that you planned, then, well, that's it. You got what you wanted. You can't go anywhere with that. But if things didn't go the way that you planned, then you get to see and you get to be there. I don't know how this is going to turn out. This is not what I wanted. This is not what I expected. And can I be okay with it? This is an opportunity to just let go and be along for the ride. And this is, yeah, it's a great way again to bring energy into the mind and practice. And if even if we have no other sense of what we're getting out of the practice, like, yeah, I don't feel like my precepts are all that strong. I don't get much samadhi, I sit and I kind of doze off. I'm still getting annoyed all the time. I'm still, snippy with, the people I talk to. We can encounter something like this, and just the fact that the mind can turn over like that can be like, oh, this is an opportunity. Maybe I can do something with this. And be like, wow, this is great. Look what my mind just did. It said, I want to be energetic. I want to practice. I want to improve. So I'm not hopeless. There's hope for me yet, because this is one of the most reliable thing. And we were just talking that you can't rely on your energy level. You can't rely on always having an open-hearted, loving response to a situation. You can't rely on always wanting to meditate. But some of the things you can start to rely on is this sense of, oh, this is an opportunity. Or, oh, what if I were to be mindful right now? Or, hey, it didn't work the last 1,000 times I responded angrily. Let's try something different. This is this sense of, well, let's try something. And this is the mind of, as I said, anybody who's really sincere about trying to learn or develop, you do this. And if you've ever been in an environment like an educational environment where I think of public school actually, where you're given a scenario that's meant to be as safe and mainstream for everybody as it can be, and you're not challenged at all. You're like, here, what's 2 + 2? And you're like, 4. You're like, good, good, good. You passed. You get to go to the next grade. And I'm like, oh, okay. You don't get much from it, But then you go to a different class where it's electronics studies class or something, and they dump a bunch of parts, and they're like, okay, make a flashlight. And you're like, I don't know how. And they're like, well, you got all the parts, and you got a battery, and you got some wires figured out. It's not that hard. And you start putting things together and you're challenged, and you try something and it doesn't work, and you try something else and it doesn't work. And lo and behold, at the end of that line of inquiry, you might have a very not exciting version of a flashlight, but you've learned a lot through the difficulty, through the being challenged, through the things not going the way that you wanted. And Kunti is like this. Kunti is this very, very process, this very, I say, quality or characteristic or power of the mind, is that we tend to learn better from challenges. And when you get that, you start to turn towards the challenges, because you want to be energetic. It's more fun, honestly. As I've said many times, like coming to be a monastic for me, it was a lot like the training environment of going to become a martial artist. It's like, I want to train the heart and the mind, so I've got to go to the right dojo, and here I am. And it's like, so how do I get better? And if you're around forest monastics, those who dwell in more austere places, you tend to see them doing all sorts of crazy things. skipping meals and skipping sleep and walking around barefoot and wearing just scraps of clothing in 40 degree weather. And you're like, what's wrong with you guys? And it's actually maybe something, you know, it's not, it doesn't work indefinitely. And I'm definitely, I've never been happier than when I was a wandering Dutanga monk, you know, out in the woods. And yet it would probably kill me to try that for too much longer in my life. But yet it was good at the time because a lot of the things that I learned and a lot of the challenges I faced, I overcame. And that you don't lose that. You never lose that. Even when you're in a nice, cozy environment, you know, it's like you just don't need stuff. You know, you're surrounded by stuff, but you don't need it because you know it's you could be perfectly happy lying on, you know, a mat on dirt in the forest. And even wistfully, at times you find yourself thinking back and you're like, I wish I was on a mat on the dirt, cool dirt in the forest right now. I would much rather be there than sitting at this particular ceremony or, you know, on this long drive as we go off to this invitation or this or that or the other thing. And yeah, that's what you're appreciating is not the experience. Like, you know, lying on a mat on mud in the forest in a rainstorm, it's not pleasant in and of itself. What you miss in those times is the energy. You're like, wow, I am fully engaged right now. Like none of me is dull and comfortable and placid. Yeah. Because everything gets to challenge. So let's take a look at a sutta and we'll see what comes out of it. It's a bit longer. We might skip through a couple of parts, but it deals it. Oh, did I freeze again? You can hear me though. You're nodding. Okay, you can hear me, but I look confused. So we'll just hope that that comes back at some point. Yeah, wow, that's kind of weird. Not sure I'm okay with that. If I can, did I come back? Oh. Technology. He was supposed to make our lives easier. Let's share the screen. Friends. So here we have the simile of the saw. And this is it talks about Kunti without necessarily coming right out and saying, hey, let's talk about Kunti. Let's talk about endurance. And yet it's all about endurance. It's all about dealing with things that are said and things that are done to us. And one thing I'd like to encourage is that as you start to investigate this experience of turning towards difficulty, what you might see is the reason we start with what is said, with verbal karma, in terms of looking for things that we can tolerate and be patient with, is because anytime that we get in a situation where something is physically happening to us, or we're being physically challenged or impeded. We can so many times trace it back to, well, there was a verbal component before this. There was a viewpoint, or there was an opinion, or there was a difficulty with somebody. Either we are trying to avoid somebody, or we're trying to get closer to somebody. Or we're trying to just deal with the fact that somebody else existed, right? And that gets us to do something, and that creates the condition for a difficulty. And this is really, really valuable in the way of seeing how thoughts condition speech, condition action. Yeah, whenever we find ourselves where we're sitting And we're trying to patiently endure a thought or a feeling or a sensation, we can usually trace some sort of thought process to our current difficulty, either how we're relating to just sitting there or what the actual quality of the thought is. And but moreover, in our day-to-day life, when we get in arguments or we have any kind of difficulty, usually there was a point before where if we were just more relaxed or more tolerant, it might not have even happened. Yeah? Whether we were tolerant with something that was good or something that was bad or something that we just didn't need to change. And this is a sutta that kind of it runs through a bunch of different scenarios, and it's the Buddha talking to a monk and not to a monk. So this sutta is kind of based around the Buddha kind of talking to this venerable Pagana. But if you read the there's a book put out on all of the Pali names in the Pali Canon, like all of the different people and who they were. If you read up on this Venerable Pagana, you find out, actually, I think there's a footnote right here. He appears in three discourses, and none of which does he distinguish himself. And in one of them, he actually disrobes and goes back to being a layperson. So the Buddha is giving a teaching not really to the Venerable Pagana. I mean, he's probably figured out that this person, he's not called forward because he is just starting to have trouble. He's like he's already having trouble, and that's what created this situation that he needs to be brought forth and sort of questioned. And that's what we're talking about, yeah? Now, the way that one thing conditions another is like his difficulty didn't start with people, as we'll read, talking poorly about bhikkhunis in his presence. It really started before that. It's like, why was he there? What was he doing? And it's kind of already going off the rails. But so that's the scenario. So I have heard at one time the Buddha was staying near Savatthi and Chaitta's Grove. That time the Venerable Pagana was spending too long mixing closely with some bhikkhunis, so much so that if any mendicant, really anyone, criticized those bhikkhunis in his presence, Venerable Pagana got angry and upset and even instigated disciplinary proceedings against those monastics. Yeah. So basically, in the monastic community, I just to say there are disciplinary proceedings. There are sort of internal politics. There's a code of disciplinary rules. There's like do this, don't do that. And there's enough going on that it's not hard to sometimes be going off to one side or the other of certain rules. And every morning here at this temple I'm at, we confess in a blanket way all of the things we could have screwed up yesterday. The assumption is we probably screwed up a couple of things, so we might as well confess. And that's part of Burmese culture, is to just do it blanket. And in the Thai culture I started in, we would try to enumerate. We would go to a monk and be like, I messed up this rule and this rule and this rule. And then we'd confess them point by point. But here it's just like, okay, yeah, no, it's life is complicated. You're going to be screwing up a bunch. Let's clean the slate every morning. But this monk is getting upset because he's getting in the way of that procedure. He's basically saying, look, I'm friends with these bhikkhunis, these nuns, and don't criticize them. Don't complain about them. Don't tell them they're doing anything wrong. They're under my protection. And when people would come, it'd be like, they're doing that wrong. They're not doing that right. They should be disciplined. They should be told that that's not the way to do it. They should confess this particular offense. He'd be like, how dare you? They're under my protection. No, you can't say this. You can't do this. And this is a very monk specific situation, but you can extrapolate, right? You can see how this might apply in your own lives. to a significant other, to a child, to a nephew or a niece, to a pet, to a neighbor, to a political party, to anything. You hear somebody talking ill about somebody else and you get defensive. And even if it's not you, right? So this is where you can start to, well, what would happen if I kept nursing that sense of defensiveness and not being able to endure those things that were being said or the criticisms that were being levied because I felt it was unfair, it was unjust, it was wrong, it shouldn't be said. If I couldn't endure it, then I might find myself doing something or in a situation that will be even more difficult to endure. I might push myself out of a situation that was otherwise working. And that's basically what the Venerable Pagana does, is he kind of pushes himself out of the holy life, out of the monasticism, by getting involved in all of these little squabbling things. Long story short, the Buddha calls him forward and asks him about it and criticizes him. He says, didn't you go forth out of faith from the lay life into homelessness? And he says, yes. Well, then it's not appropriate for you to mix closely with women. Well, for one, this the orders were separate for a reason. It just looks bad from time to time for you to be hanging out all the time at the other monastery. It's like, why have your own monastery if you're going to hang out with the other order all of the time? But also, and more to the point, because you're doing that, you get very protective and very defensive whenever anybody criticizes you and whenever anybody criticizes those other monastics. And the Buddha says you should give up desires or thoughts connected with the lay life so that when anybody criticizes those bhikkhunis, you should train yourself. My mind will not degenerate. I won't blurt out bad words. I will remain full of sympathy with a heart of love and no secret hate. And the Buddha uses this phrase, Sakkitabha, this is how you should train. And this is, it's not a, thou shalt, but it's like, this is the conduct of somebody who is trying to get better, who's trying to get out of suffering. He's saying, this is a pitfall. And this is how you get out of this pitfall. It's in the endurance, it's in the tolerance, it's in the patience. He's not saying do this or do that. He's saying, look at what you're getting yourself into by following this causal train from thoughts to words to actions to reactions. You get yourself out by learning to endure and by not following this to its end conclusion. So even if somebody strikes those bhikkhunis with fists or stones or rods or swords in your presence, you should still be able to give up any desires or thoughts of the lay life. And I know my audience, and some people would be like, what? If somebody is there beating up bhikkhunis, you're going to do nothing? Is that what the Buddha is saying? It's like, clearly that's what he's saying. No, because the reality was nobody was breaking into the bhikkhuni monastery and beating them up and hitting them over the head with stones and sticks. It's a hypothetical scenario, yeah. Just like the one that comes at the end of this sutta, the Buddha is saying you don't have to get if you're the thing is people are just criticizing them for things that they're legitimately doing wrong, and you're getting upset, and that's creating so much suffering for you. The gist of it is. You take it the other way, well, an actually not very likely scenario that they would get beaten up. Even in that situation, you getting angry and defensive and upset and suffering and losing track of your monasticism and the vows that you've taken, even in that scenario, you shouldn't give up being a monastic. You shouldn't throw away your mindfulness and give in to violence and heated words. So much more so when it's not a serious situation. when it is just legitimate criticism for something that they're doing wrong. And maybe they don't even care that much. Maybe you're the only one making a problem out of it. And then the Buddha kind of, in the same way I was just kind of saying, well, I used to wander about and sleep on the ground and only eat, a couple of handfuls of food a day. And oh, I was so happy. The Buddha is saying, mendicants, I used to be so satisfied with the monks. Once I address them, I eat food in one sitting per day. And doing so, I find that I'm healthy and well, nimble, strong, and live comfortably. You too should eat your food in one sitting per day. Doing so, you'll find yourself healthy, well, nimble, strong, living comfortably. And I didn't have to keep on instructing them. I just had to prompt their mindfulness, and away they would go. He said, suppose a chariot stood harnessed to thoroughbreds at a level crossroad with the goad, the whip ready, and a deft horse trainer, a master charioteer, might get on that chariot and take the reins in his hand and the goad in his left, and he'd drive out and back wherever he wished, whenever he wished. I don't know, I want to bring that similarly into the modern day. It's like when you have a car that works and you turn the key and it works and you immediately go down the road. Some of us are, we turn the key and it kind of sputters. And if we're talking about our mind, we want it to go in a particular direction and it doesn't right away. It's a simile for the willingness to train. The more we do this, the easier it becomes for us to shift into this mind state whenever we recognize an opportunity. Oh, look, this is a chance to practice. This is a chance to train. This is a chance to develop ourselves. So this is a chance to get out of repeated recurring suffering that we are experiencing over and over again. This is how we do it. This is what we can develop tolerance for. As I said, we'll kind of skip through this. Suppose that not far from a town or village, there was a large grove of sal trees that was choked with castor oil weeds. Then along comes a person who wants to help protect and nurture that grove. They'd cut down the crooked sal saplings that were robbing the sap. They'd throw them out. They'd clean up the interior of the grove and properly care for the straight, well-formed saplings. In due course, the sal grove would grow, increase, and mature. In the same way, mendicants, you too should give up what's unskillful and devote yourself to skillful qualities. Doing this, you'll achieve growth, improvement, and maturity in this teaching and training. And now we get into a really interesting story that I'll read out because I think this will stick with you this afternoon because it deals with, we'll talk about it after. So, once upon a time, mendicants, right here in the Savatthi, there was a housewife named Videhika, and she had a good reputation. The housewife, Videhika, is sweet, she's even tempered, and she is calm. And now, Videhika had a maidservant, slave, who was deft, tireless, and well organized in her work. And Kali thought, the slave's name was Kali. And Kali thought, my mistress has a good reputation as being this sweet, even tempered, and calm person. But is she actually sweet and even tempered and calm? Or does she actually have anger in her and just not show it? Does she have no anger? Or is it just because my work is well organized that she doesn't show anger, even though it is still inside of her? Why don't I test her? And so one day, Kali got up late, and Videhika went to her and she said, "Ah, wench." That's Sabbante Sujata. You so rarely get to use the word wench in a sentence. "What is it, ma'am? You're getting up in the day. What's wrong with you, wench?" "Nothing, ma'am." "Oh, so nothing's up, you naughty maid, but you get up late in the day." Angry and upset, Videhika went off scowling. And then Kali thought, wow, she actually has anger in her and she just doesn't show it. It's not that she has no anger. It's just because my work is well organized that she doesn't show anger, even though she still has it inside. Why don't I test her further? The next day she got up even later in the day. And Videika came to her and she's like, "Wench, what is it, ma'am? You're getting up even later in the day. What is up with you?" And she's like, "Oh, nothing's up." And again, she was upset. And she blurted out angry words, expletives. She was cursing. She wandered away. And Kali's like, "Okay, yeah, very interesting. She actually has anger in her, and it's just that she doesn't show it. Because my work was well organized and I was on time, she didn't show the anger that she still has inside." And finally, one day she gets up even later in the day, and Videika comes to her and she says, "What's up with you?" And Kali says, "Oh, nothing's up, man." And Videika says, "So nothing's up, you naughty maid, but you're getting up so late in the day." And angry and upset, she grabbed a rolling pin and hit Kali on the head, cracking it open. Then Kali, with blood pouring down from her cracked skull, denounced her mistress to the neighbors. I don't think she had a head. I don't think her brain was leaking out or anything. As soon as you cut her head, I'm assuming. Yeah. "See, ladies, see what that sweet one did. See what that even-tempered one did. See what that calm one did. How on earth could she grab a rolling pin with and hit her only maid on the head, cracking it open just for getting up late?" Then, after some time, the housewife Videika got a bad reputation as this spread about. She is fierce, ill-tempered, and not calm at all. In the same way, a mendicant may be the sweetest of the sweet, the most even-tempered of the even-tempered, the calmest of the calm, so long as they don't encounter any disagreeable criticism. But it's when they encounter disagreeable criticism that you'll know whether they're sweet, even-tempered, and calm. I don't say that a mendicant is easy to admonish if they make themselves easy to admonish only for the sake of robes, alms with lodgings, and medicines. Why is that? Because when they don't get robes, alms food, lodgings, and medicines, they might no longer be easy to admonish. But when they're easy to admonish purely because they honor, respect, revere, worship, and venerate the teaching, then I say that they're truly easy to admonish. And this again going back to it's using monasticism as an example of this, but this willingness to train. And when you're truly willing to train, then if somebody comes to you and says, "Look, you did it, you're not doing this training rule right, you're actually committing an offense here," you'll go, "Oh, well, thank you for letting me know." Yeah. And it's not that, when you're at a really good monastery and you're getting lots of good requisites, you'll say, "Okay, yes, sure, I'll do it however you want me to do it because I like living here." But because when your mind state is, "Oh, I want to do it right. Thank you for pointing it out. I guess I'll do better." Even though it never feels good to be criticized, it never feels good to have something pointed out that you're doing wrong. Still, you start to develop this sense of, "I just want to do it right for right's sake. It feels to me there could be a better way to do it. And maybe someday I can get to a place where I feel really good and confident about the way I'm doing it, no matter what people are saying." Yeah. And people will always criticize you in some ways. So the sutta goes on. The Buddha says, "Monks, there are five ways in which others might criticize you. Their speech might be timely or untimely, true or false, gentle or harsh, beneficial or harmful, from a heart of love or from secret hate. When others criticize you, they may do so in any of these ways. And if that happens, you should train your minds thus. Our minds will not degenerate. We will not blurt out bad words. We will remain full of sympathy with a heart of love and no secret hate. We will meditate spreading a heart of love to that person. And with them as a basis, we will meditate spreading a heart full of love to everyone in the world. Abundant, expansive, limitless, free of enmity and ill will. And that is how you should train." Suppose a person was to come along carrying a spade and a basket and say, "I shall make this great earth be without earth." They dig all over, scatter all over, spit all over, urinate all over, saying, "Be without earth, be without earth." What do you think? Could they make the great earth be without earth? I don't know how to really relate this to something that makes sense in the English language more. It's like, suppose it was a public earth, like a public construction project, and they would come and be like, "Okay, I didn't get down to the bedrock here. I'm gonna get all of this dirt out of the way." And they were to kick dirt and spray dirt and sweep dirt. And would they ever get to a point where there's no dirt? Probably not, because the earth is made of dirt. I mean, theoretically, a couple of miles down, you're going to hit nothing but rock, but in the human lifespan, is not really feasible that you're going to get to a point where there's no dirt. And that's what this person is trying to do. What is this? The Buddha's relating it to criticism. Yeah. Suppose somebody comes along and you're not doing anything wrong, and they say, be without dirt. You're doing it wrong. You're doing it wrong. Well, what are they going to reap for their efforts but just weariness? If you're not doing anything wrong, you have nothing to worry about. If you are doing something wrong, well then, oh great, thanks for letting me know. I'll change my ways. Yeah. But it says, suppose a person came along with dyes such as red lac, turmeric, indigo, or rose, and say, I shall draw pictures in space, making pictures appear there. Could they do it? And no, you can't draw a picture in midair. The dye of the paint, the perfume, it just falls out of the air as soon as you toss it up there. It doesn't create a lasting picture. And the Buddha's relating criticism to this. And suppose a person was to come along carrying a blazing grass torch and say, I shall burn and evaporate the whole river Ganges with this grass torch. Would they be able to do it? And the monks say, no. Why? Because even monks know how fire works. You couldn't possibly create enough fire to evaporate the river Ganges. Suppose there was a catskin bag that was rubbed, well rubbed. This is like a leather bag, and it was soft and silky, and it never rustled, never crackled. It wasn't stiff. And that person came along, with a stick or a stone, and they said, "I'm going to make it rustle and crack and scratchy." And what do you think? With this smooth, well-worn bag, could they turn it into a crinkly, crackly, stiff bag? And the monk's like, "No, it's well smoothed." And this is all of these are similes that people trained with back in the Buddhist time. That simile, like the catskin bag, this was a meditation subject that people would take with them into the forest. They would, in the same way, when we sit in meditation, we pay attention to mindfulness of the body, right? And we're attentive to what we're feeling, the sensations that are coming up. And in some ways, we feel tension in a part of the body. We can ask ourselves, like, where is that tension coming from? What am I holding on to that tension is still there? And sometimes through investigation, we can start to, oh, you see, I have been kind of tense. I have been kind of like leaning into that for some reason. It's been going on for hours, for days, for weeks, even. Ah, now I can breathe a bit better. I can let it go. And as we do, that sensation, that tension begins to dissipate and goes away. And it's like our body becomes smooth, soft, light, airy, cool, calm. Yeah. And this is, it's a meditation subject. It's a method of investigation. It is using biofeedback, the way that our mind conditions our experience of the body. We can look at the experience of the body to know what the mind is and has been doing. Unravel that. And then when the body feels at peace, the mind is almost always also at peace. And so by getting your body to be like this catskin bag, where even if people came and did like gross, violent, oppressive things, you wouldn't become tense. You wouldn't become frustrated. You wouldn't become hot and bothered by it. That's when you've succeeded in creating a mind that has kanti, tolerance, as is basic innate power. Here we get to this very great sutta, which you can see on the website that Laura has drawn in various ways. Even if low-down bandits were to sever you limb from limb with a two-handed saw, anyone who had a malevolent thought on that account would not be following my instructions. Even if that were to happen, you should train yourselves. Our minds will not degenerate. We will not blurt out bad words. We will remain full of sympathy with a heart of love and no secret hate. We will meditate spreading a heart of love to that person. And with them as a basis, we will meditate spreading a heart full of love to everyone in the world, abundant, expansive, limitless, free of enmity and ill will. That is how you should train. And if you were to frequently reflect on this advice, the simile of the saw, do you see any criticism, large or small, that you could not endure? No, venerable sir. So mendicants frequently reflect on this advice of the simile of the saw. This will be for your long lasting welfare and happiness. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So that is Majjhima Nikaya number 21, the simile of the saw. And this is the advice, yeah? It's the most absurd of situations. People in the modern day, oh, so rarely are getting ganged up on by a mob and having people come with a dull two-handed saw and taking their limbs off one by one. It just doesn't happen so much. But were it to happen, you should, yeah, you're going anyway. You have two choices. You can go with a mind full of hate, or you can go saying, well, there's my arm. Oh, there's my foot. Oh, there's my knee. Huh. That's your choice. Yeah. But now the reality is, if in that circumstance, you would see that, well, the only person who would get hurt by you having a mind of hate is yourself. And not the bandits. They will still get all the body parts that they really want to cut up. Then it makes no sense for me to cultivate a mind of hate and annoyance and frustration and grievance. If even in that situation, the mind of hate is not worth it, then why, when somebody leaves the toilet seat up or doesn't replace something in the fridge and leaves it out on the counter, or when they come into the home with muddy shoes and make a mess that we have to clean up after, why then do we think that a mind of hate is justified, and that if we don't say something, they'll do it again in the future, so we've got to make sure that they experience the full force of our vengeance? Why then do we give into these mind states? That those should be the easy ones, right? But it's funny that were we in a completely unavoidable physical situation, often we would find that something would kick in and we would be like, okay, nope, now's the time for letting go. But when it seems like something that we have control over, that we should say something, we should really let them know that we are not okay with this, that we get ourselves into the most trouble. Yeah? Those are the times when we should be practicing kunti, endurance, and trust that when we make that the basic power, the reflex of the mind, we don't even have to worry about the physical circumstances. Those will come up and we'll be like, oh, it's just another thing to let go of. All right. So with these thoughts, again, we'll sit and walk for about an hour and a half. And if any of us are still here, we haven't been severed savagely by bandits with saws, we can get together and just at 4:30, whatever conversation you might have, we'll have it at that time. So enjoy your afternoon sittings.